With me is James McLean, and I'm Christian Corley. No Brian Terranova this week, sadly. Now, you join us on the evening of Father's Day, so I'm enjoying a pint, mostly a pint, a large volume of Krabby's ginger beer in a brand new tankard from my small children. Because I have three children, which is enough for all three of us. So, you know, no one gets left out in the podcast with a K. Or something. James, how are you?
I'm okay. did they buy it for you specially?
They did buy it for me specially, yeah.
Did they? Did they actually go to the cashier and purchase the Krabby's beer for you?
No, they didn't buy the Krabby's. No, okay, well,
Krabby's. Right, okay, so they didn't actually. So it's
I thought you were talking about the tankard, which they did.
Oh, the tankard they did. They yes. went up and they
the man, the myth, the legend, it says on it. Dad's
okay,
so drinking.
Not your tankard then. Someone else's tankard that they borrowed.
Yeah, they borrowed it, yeah.
No, they were running late on time to actually get this Father's Day malarkey
precisely,
sorted.
Precisely.
You see through their games.
Yes. So we're here to discuss the Eaters of Light, which is the 10th episode of Doctor Who Series 10.
Unlike yes,
last
finally.
Week, where I got it wrong. Yeah, we got there eventually. Listen, we were a bit late with last week's podcast. That's purely down to some technical issues at my end. So, sorry about that. So, if you've got two to listen to in a short amount of time, what I recommend is you listen to this one because it's just me and James. There'll be nothing from Brian in this one. So,
that's an interesting recommendation.
Actually, no, there will be a I think we've got
There's a few
words
comments,
from Brian,
isn't
haven't we? Yeah.
He sent a message.
He did. And he also sent us some comments. So, that's nice.
Yeah.
So, Rona Munro was the pen behind the Eaters of Light. Which, you know, the Eaters of Light feels like a New Adventures or Big Finish title to me.
Yeah, a lot of people have said similar.
Yeah.
They said, yes, it feels, or a short story, or
yeah.
short trips. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. Rona Munro, new Who fans may not know this, classic Who fans will do, or you might be completely... If you listen to the podcast with a K, you probably do know. She hasn't written a Doctor Who story in 28 years, but she wrote Survival, which was the...
I think you've got to be careful, because I've found I've met a lot of New Who fans who'll get quite on their pedestal that they know a lot about the classic show. In fact, they'll still go, I know I'm the biggest Doctor Who fan ever. And
indeed,
go, right, yeah,
indeed.
Really?
But
and
they'll
go,
some
yeah,
might
I know,
not know.
Yeah, I know everything. And you're just like, okay, really? And they go, yeah, I know everything. And you'd sort of say, who did Survival? And they'll go, Rona Munro. And you'd just say, well, then you're a dick, really, aren't you? Because, you know, there's nothing to be proud about, that you know everything about Doctor Who. It's an insular show. We come on here, we have books, we have textbooks, we have the internet, we pretend to know something about it, but ultimately, you know, it's just because we were children when we watched it and we've grown up with a sort of comfort blanket around it, or we haven't grown up. You, however, are probably about 15 to 16 years old, and you've chosen to identify your coming into manhood with this show and its 50-year baggage, and then you think that you can one-up me on that score. No, you failed. As you tried to pedestal yourself.
Have we inadvertently unearthed an incident from your past, James?
No, absolutely not. I find it's cute, really. But I think as soon as you sort of say I am the biggest fan in anything, I think ultimately you're going to be in a big shocker, because there's always a biggest fan, bigger fan than you. Well, again, you can replace fan Ridian, maybe, I don't know.
With another word. Okay. Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do the audience figures first, and then we can just get on and talk about it. Okay.
Okay.
So, Eaters of Light has hit an overnight viewing figure of 2.89 million viewers, which is low.
Down a bit.
It's low. Yeah. However, it's a share of 22% of the audience, which is
so
over 1% up. Yeah. The weather has clearly impacted Saturday night TV this weekend. It is, if you're overseas, if you're in the United States or Australia or Canada, where I know, or Italy, for some reason, well, I know a lot of our listeners are, you will be surprised to learn that it is positively Mediterranean weather in the UK at the moment.
It's fairly hideous, isn't it? Though?
Yeah, even where I live, which is, you know, used to sort of like sub-zero storms for most of the year, it's...
It's twofold in its hideousness, isn't it? It's hideous in the fact that it's hideous weather, but it also means that I am now sitting here in sort of pyjama top, bottoms and no top, looking hideous. So it's sort of a hideous begets hideousness, which is just not very British. I mean, I like to be fully, fully clothed.
I think we'd all like you to be as well. Yeah.
I'm sympathetic to that. That resonates with me. I know that people want me to be fully clothed. Maybe because they write it on my window in excrement or something, and that's how I know I need to be fully clothed. But yeah, I mean, when I was living in America, I was always fully clothed. You know, I was really British like that. You know, people else would be shorts, never wore shorts. I'd wear sort of beige sort of chino things, or, you know, that sort of almost skin colour. But no, British
right.
don't.
Okay.
Don't.
Yes.
Don't.
So yeah, so it's a strange weather here.
They don't, Christian.
No.
I bet you do, actually. I bet you do. I bet you're a big shorts, hairy legged sort of guy.
I am wearing shorts today. I have like 3 pairs of shorts, so I have to be very precise when I wear my shorts.
I mean, the biggest Doctor Who fan, the new Who fan, is saying that the Doctor has never worn shorts. I'm not sure if he's quite right on that. Probably not.
Sylvester McCoy?
Does he wear shorts?
Or is that an off? Is that a rehearsal?
As the Doctor, the Doctor is not Sylvester McCoy.
No,
they're two separate entities. One plays the other. Let's not merge.
No. I agree. No, I think I'm thinking of a. Like an offset photo, aren't I? Or a location photo.
I can't possibly think of any in shorts. Can you? I can't. I can't think of any legs exposure.
No. Only,
I mean, I can think of a shower, you know, space. But beyond actual leg exposure in shorts, no, I can't think of any. Maybe the listener, who is obviously the biggest Doctor Who fan ever, will know. But has he ever worn shorts?
Not on TV. We're pretty certain. It's bound to have gone in a drama.
Exactly. If you know it in a drama or in a book, then let us know as well. I want to know if he's wearing shorts, and I can't be bothered to look it up. So if you know more than me, which I'm sure you do, do my job for me and let us know. That'd be cool. So where were we?
The Eaters of Light by Ronan Munro.
Oh, yeah, that. Yeah.
Which, so it seems to have gone down quite well. There's no one saying, my God, that was terrible. No one's hailing it as a classic, but it's certainly come along quite. It's a. I mean, I described it as a robust, entertaining tale. Nothing offensive about it. Some good stuff going on in there. Maybe we've got the old, oh, it's just a monster, inadvertent. It's a hunter type of creature, isn't it? So it's more sort of. More Nymon than Dalek, I suppose, but it's got some good character stuff going on. I think that's the core of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the monster is a bit like Vincent the Doctor. It's largely irrelevant, apart from its. I think there were some things that sounded interesting with it. The ink sounded interesting, the oily ink that it left. That sound, but it was never really focused on.
No.
And the way that it the remains of people looked fairly icky, which was interesting, but he didn't really play into it enough. I don't know, it just felt a bit. I think again, it's one of those things where when you saw in this full near the end, it didn't look very impressive, but I quite liked it when you could just see the tendrils was quite.
Yeah, they were a bit video gamey, weren't they?
Yeah.
I've seen creatures in video games with them, same sort of glowing.
But I think without the actual body to it, the tentacles didn't look as video gamey as when you saw it, say, galloping towards them with the tentacles and the sort of larger, sort of almost sort of feline, sort of battle cat comboed with tentacle.
Battle cat. There's a phrase I haven't heard for a long time.
Oh, well, you know, I heard it frequently a few months ago when I was watching every episode on Netflix.
But every episode of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
He-Man and the Masters.
Well, you would do, wouldn't you?
You would. Because
it's probably the only place where you would hear it regularly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Apart from the recordings that I make in my room.
Battle Cat. What, with the figurines?
Battle Cat. The Special Adventures.
Yeah. I always found with those toys that they didn't really reflect what was going on in the cartoon.
Well, I think that was actually a policy thing, is that Filmation was very keen, Lou Schreiner was very keen not to have the cartoon to become simply just a conduit for toys.
Right.
So there was a certain amount of tension there between what the toys were doing and what the Filmation was doing, and there was a sort of mix going backwards and forth to some degree, and I think later on there became a little more of a toy emphasis. But yeah, so I think the cartoon informed a lot of where the toys went. And how the aesthetic moved, which I think is kind of cool. So Yeah, incidentally, if you're not interested in Doctor Who and you're interested in He-Man and you're He-Man's biggest fan, you'll already know this. But there's a YouTube channel to He-Man, which is official, which has many of the best episodes and commentaries as well. Like I say, it's an official one, so you're not watching stuff which is illegal. It's all totally fine, and it has bits of the soundtrack, and there's loads of stuff. So if you're looking for a bit of a nostalgia fest, or you just want to know what I'm talking about, have a look for He-Man on YouTube. You'll find their official
site. It's interesting what you say there, because the Transformers was similar. And I am going to bring this back to Doctor Who in a moment.
Okay.
But, you know, the Transformers figures, initially, the cartoon characters looked very different to the toys.
I was going to say that's because the Transformers was a Japanese product.
Exactly, yeah.
Which they bought. It was a weird thing they did with the States side. I'm trying to think. I think Hasbro, they bought. I'm trying to think which way round it was. They called something. The names are utterly different in the Japanese line. And I think that they bought the image. They bought the toys to fit a brand, brand they wanted to do. Yeah. So
I think the original Japanese toys, if you look at the original Optimus Prime, there's space in there for characters. The same as with the jet fighters, there's space in there for someone to sit in there. And I think the original Japanese cartoon had people in.
I don't think there was an original Japanese cartoon. It was a Japanese toy line, which Hasbro bought on the premise that they were going to do a sort of cross merchandise. So, yeah, but I mean, the point being is that the toys, the cartoon came after the toys and was reflecting a sort of, it was really weird. Fascinating again. Not sure there's a YouTube channel out there. I'm sure the listener who is the Transformers biggest fan ever will know all this. But yeah, there's some really interesting stuff on Transformers, a really interesting legacy.
Now, the point I was going to make is that what you said about the toy line, the cartoon leading the toy line, that certainly happened with Transformers, because over the years, the toys became more and more like the recognizable cartoon version. And the comics did the same. They moved away from things that looked like the toys into the cartoon characters.
And yeah.
So that's leading it. And I think, wouldn't it be interesting if Doctor Who toys were allowed to lead a bit more, rather than just replicate episode characters? If they could just go off in their own direction somewhere,
do their own, yeah.
Yeah.
So there would be less of a sort of honorary or to the actual show, and be their own range of exploring Doctor Who.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that could be quite interesting.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, the Transformers is really interesting. I wish I could remember the details. I'll probably try and find the next podcast, but there is a fact, because as you say, I think there then became a sort of like political war between toy manufacturers and the state side, where the state side, I think, started to have more power than the toy manufacturers.
I'm pretty certain Hasbro bought up characters from different toy manufacturers in
there
Japan.
There was two toy man. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You're totally right there. There's two toy manufacturers and they bought them up. They bought from two separate to create their own thing. Mm. And then that started to give them power leverage with those in Japan, I think it was, because they became reliant on that relationship, which I think has happened before with Japan and American stuff, Astro Boy, I think, a similar thing. Really, really interesting stuff. But anyway, so sorry, we've gone way off tangent.
The Eaters of Light. Now, apparently it was filmed in Scotland.
Really?
A lot of commentary about this has been, I'm talking press commentary, has been that it was filmed in Scotland. I'd assume that they just, you know, dressed bits of Wales to look like Scotland. Yeah.
Well, it's one of the few times where, they could have just dressed up bits of Wales, probably. But there were some really quite stunning shots in there. So I'm kind of glad they did. There's a couple of hill shots, which are really nice. Some really valley terrains in the background that just gives it a feeling of expanse and size, which you could have probably found in Wales. I think you're right. But
I'd like to get to the bottom of this, because it's not conclusive on the Wikipedia page.
Oh, right, okay, so it could just be Wales.
It could just be Wales, yeah. But no, it was beautiful. Was it Charles Palmer? Yeah, it was Charles Palmer who directed it.
That was really nice.
Yeah, there's some very good shots in there. I liked the stones at the beginning were just shouting stones of blood to me. And I did think there was going to be some stone movement at one point. But what do you think this dimensional portal around the cairns?
What do I think of it?
Yeah.
What did I think of it?
That idea, if that's what they're there, that's what that cairn is there to do, to protect her.
I think it's nice. I don't think they fully I don't think they really managed to get that across very well. I think there was probably an issue here, which I know some people alluded to, that they felt that it was a bit crushed, maybe, or maybe it wasn't quite as even paced as people would like. I don't know. It felt, I like the fact, you know, we were talking last week about the Mars one. This one did what the Mars one should have done and just started with them landing there and just coming out and then straight in. That was exactly what they should have done with the Mars one with the TARDIS. You know, we were saying that they didn't need the NASA opener.
Yeah, just need to
go straight into the action. This is what this one did effectively, apart from that minor tease in the teaser. But yeah, no, I don't think that sort of came across very well. I didn't feel it was very well explained. I sort of understood what they were doing and what they meant and how it was rolling. But I don't know. I think some of the key aspects of the episode didn't quite filter through the script well enough. They didn't quite... Did you feel that at all? I mean, about the creature, about... And maybe it wasn't important. Maybe that's the point. Maybe it didn't really matter that much.
What aspect of the creature?
Well,
anything about it?
Really about anything about it, about, as you say, the nature of the Kern, the nature of the temporal displacement, the temporal displacement occurred, because I almost got the feeling when I was watching, when he goes in initially, the temporal displacement was actually within inside the building, not actually... pretty much going up and towards and into the into the portal, because he doesn't look like he goes fully. Oh, I think he.
Just steps into it, doesn't he?
A little bit, but that's what I mean. So when they came running in, I also at one moment thought that was the 2 second, or you know that was the area, was actually the interior, which would have been mad because people were going in there all the time. So that doesn't make any sense. But I just think maybe if we're talking direction, some of the visuals weren't horrendously clear in something which was a fairly complicated idea, not massively complicated, but needed to be sort of fairly clearly illustrated to make it all make sense.
What about,
and for the ending.
Yeah, what about this idea of light eating?
I think one of the things I didn't like about it was, again, it was one of these, this something's going to come and destroy absolutely everything. I kind of felt that they could have localized it and it would have just made it feel a little more grounded and in place with the episode, that there was just going to be this creature that would just run rampant, eating and destroying people. I mean, the idea of it taking the light is kind of cool. I like it as a notion. It didn't feel like it quite fitted the subtleties of the story.
Hmm.
The story was kind of down quite... It was obviously pseudo-historical.
Yeah.
And as such, it didn't feel the place to have what, you know, this creature have come through that's going to sort of consume everything. It just felt too grandiose for something which felt like it was going to be quite minimalistic and... I don't know. So that bit I wasn't over keen on. There was a few things in it I wasn't over keen on, but I generally felt that the pacing and the Doctor specifically felt far more in keeping with the first 5 episodes.
Yeah.
I mean, he had, and I just said this on Facebook, I don't quite understand why they seem to find it so hard to write for him. He's such a passionate actor, and yet he actually very rarely gets passionate scenes. Even this series, there's been a lot of him being quite withdrawn and quite withheld and quite subtle and quite comfortably chilled and almost sinisterly chilled. But there's those moments which, you know, which you sometimes like that contrast with, is where you see that person come alive and you go, right, this is the moment. They've not really been there, and they've not been there for most of his reign. Those times where you just wanted to turn around and just take control. And he can do that because he's got that energy, but they just don't seem to write it into the character much.
Yeah.
And so while I've enjoyed him through this series, he still hasn't had that much of it. He's had a couple of speeches, but this was the first time I really felt that there was a bit of that old promised Capaldi, a little bit of the Malcolm Tucker, not too much, but just a little bit of that passion that he does well. And
I think too much would be inappropriate, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, but I think there's times when you watch something. I'm trying to think of what shows I'm thinking of, whether it be things something like, I'm thinking of Scrubs, where you have Dr. Cox, you have, I'm thinking of Jeff Winger in Community. I'm thinking of characters, and there's ones, even better examples than that, just not coming to my head right now, where you're almost waiting for that moment where they turn round and they just sort of platform and just take control of the stage, and they become the centre. And that's a really powerful, you know, it's almost a very cathartic moment for the audience to go, yeah, this is it. This is where he comes out and he really hits it home.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing you want from Capaldi. As you say, you want him to be, the majority of the time, to be quite laid back, that chilled, sort of slightly confident sort of swagger he's had this series. But then there should be moments where he just turns around and he just nails it and he just takes control. So it's like it's a character that is quite withdrawn, quite himself, he's fine. But if you fire him up, you really feel it. And I just not felt that much, really. In his entire reign, I've not really felt that much. And especially when he has an adversary. As soon as he has an adversary, they seem to not write for him anymore. I mean, as soon as Missy's around, they seem to just give her all the great one-liners and all the big speeches and all the great looks. And he has to stand there looking sort of fairly sort of outmatched. You think, why? He's a really powerful, passionate actor. It's a really powerful character. Why is he being outspoken by all these other people?
Sidelined.
He's sidelined. Yeah, he gets sidelined. Why? And this was an episode, okay, it was children, so it'd be pretty bad if the children had sidelined him. But you don't want that. It's like, you know, House used to do it as well. I mean, obviously he used to do it all the time. But you like that. I mean, it's like that episode, it was Caretaker, wasn't it, in Series 8, where Clara at the end turns around, and we said about this at the time, and has this big go at him.
Yeah.
And he just stands there like an idiot. And then she walked, and you're waiting, you're thinking, yeah, in a moment he's going to turn around, and he's going to flip this scene around. And he doesn't. He just stands there. He's like, what? But that's what the audience want. The audience wants to see him flip the scene round. Mm. That's what they want. Mm. She's being emotional. You want him to pin, not necessarily, totally knock her down. There's some relevant points there, but to stand his ground. And the same with Missy. Missy would come in and do all these clever comments and all these things, and he'd just stand there. You think, what the hell's going on? So yeah, when you get those moments, and I think that was what was nice with Bill earlier this series, where I think it was the second episode, wasn't it, where he actually starts. Or was it the first episode where he just turns round and he starts sort of telling her to sort of, oh, it was the one in Victoria in London, wasn't it?
Could have been.
Get off your high horse sort of thing. Deal with it.
Yeah.
This is what I do. And those moments are what you want. And I think sometimes shows lose that understanding that audiences are looking for television. I think it's John Ellis who said, I've got to be careful who said this. It's John Ellis who said, you know, all television's there for people to sort of work through things, that they work through either the moralities or politics or whatever around life, that, you know, it becomes a medium where they sort of, they work through these processes through the television. And that's what I think fiction does. The things that drama create, the issues that drama manifests, which you will understand for it to be drama, then you're looking for some people in the cast, some people in the principal to turn around and sort of give that feeling of what you can't say that they will say about that issue, which you will then digest. Mm-hmm. You are this is the light eaters. You are the sort of, I don't know, you're the ET yourself. You're sitting there in front of the television looking for this interesting ideas for you to consume and mull over, and then sort of considering your own life and sort of place what you see on television, you map it onto your own world. Where does it relate to you? You know, where are these issues relatable to you? And in here, we obviously have this issue of conflict, of tension, of conflict. Is it pointless? Why is it pointless? It's almost arbitrary, these two sides. Why are they fighting? Do they have to fight? And there's another issue, and they're still fighting. And how much is that in our lives, whether it's on the local level or on the national level or the global level? And so, yeah, I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah,
sorry, I've not been drinking. I know I'm a bit lively, but I just am.
No, it's good. It's good. It's. I mean, I'd largely agree with you. Yeah, just going back to the. There's a couple of things. There was when the Doctor and Nardole are at knife, sword, spear point. When he sticks his hand in the air, with his palm outstretched and his fingers, it was very Tom Baker.
Yes. There was a couple of Tom Baker bits. There's a bit where he starts to, where he does, it's just one shot, just where it just kills a shot, and he's just laughing. No, he doesn't laugh, he smiles, and the scene cuts.
Is that when he's got a plan?
Yes, yeah. And it's just that look, and it just feels very Tom Baker.
It does, yeah. And also, the children. This is like the first, is this the first Doctor Who with children in, where you didn't want to kill all the children afterwards?
Yeah, they were pretty good, weren't they?
They were really good, yeah.
I'd had no issue with the children. Yeah. No one was particularly irritating, and when they were irritating, they were meant to be. It was really well cast.
Rather than teasing, we should probably just find out what Brian had to say about it.
Yeah, go on.
So he observes that it's two episodes in a row where Bill falls in the hole.
Yeah, that's true. She does falling into the hole quite well, though.
it's a niche a niche area for actors.
Absolutely, but she does it well.
Yep. He says he's not too keen on the talking crows. I thought it was quite a good idea, actually.
I like them. I thought it was fine. It was okay. Now it falls back into this whole thing that everything talks, which is a little silly, but, you know,
it's a bit quirky. It's a bit Discworld as well.
It's a bit Discworld, and I thought it was kind of fun. I thought it was kind of fun the way that it was really there to play in, play to a pun at the end, or obviously the sound of the crow. And it wasn't a pun, sorry, but it was to play to a... And it was kind of hoping that you, the audience, wouldn't catch that, was where it was going to go. And I thought, yeah, okay, that was fun. So, no, I had no problem with that. My major problem, actually, with the episode, again, is Nardole. That while I like Nardole as a character, I think he's really poorly written for. And again, we've spoken about this, but he, to me, should be an Alfred. He should be a sort of slightly irritable Alfred. That is when he's good. Mm. And that relationship with the Doctor, that tension, and the humour that comes from that tension, makes it. But when he starts doing the sort of Matt Lucas stuff, the sort of silly jokes and the silly one-liners and the silly anecdotes, which they're just not sharp enough. They're not on the nail enough to be good.
Well, for that type of character, I mean, if you went more in the direction that you're suggesting there, and I think I agree with you, I do, it wouldn't even have had to have been Matt Lucas anyway. It didn't have to be Nardole. It could have been just a brand new character, because it was, you know, a brand new series with a completely new starting point for the Doctor.
Yeah.
So they didn't even need that element of continuity, did they?
And they seem to be sort of slightly awkward about it. It's as if they are aware that there is a sort of slight discontinuity to it, which they could sort out, but they just don't really want to go there.
Mm.
So quite how it's their sort of relationship sort of felt came about is just sort of been glossed a little. But that's just simply, I mean, the word, as we've said before, I mean, I hated the Christmas episode, but his relationship with the Doctor was the best thing in it. And then in the pilot, his relationship with the Doctor was very good. The humour at the beginning of Oxygen was really good. That worked. There was humour in it, but it was based around the fact that Nardole was feeling that he had a position of power, which was totally being undermined by the person who gave him the position of power. And there was the humour, and it didn't have to be any sort of silly gags. But he seems to be playing this comic relief line that he doesn't need to be playing.
Mm.
And it's as if they're not very confident in the character that he could be playing. I mean, for God's sake, I mean, even if they just had to... I've been reading... a book by Pat Mills, who was the creator of 2000 AD and Judge Dredd, or one of the developer of Judge Dredd, as he likes to call himself. And he was sort of saying this whole thing that, you know, that you, for him, he feels that your characters work best is when you draw them from people that you knew and you use them to sort of template your fictional characters. And you just feel that with Nardole is that if you just see him as Alfred, you don't have to write him exactly like Alfred, but if you just picture him as Alfred, you can put him in that position in that episode. It would be horrendously different to a lot of the situation to where Nardole is structured in the episode, but you would be writing those silly lines with him.
Yeah,
you know, you'd just be. It's weird.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Pat Mills with a Roman Doctor Who episode.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I suppose so. Now, being people don't know that Pat Mills has written a lot about. He's very interested in Celtic mythology and history stuff. So
yeah, and he wrote paganism. And he wrote the Iron Legion.
And the Iron Legion for Doctor Who, yeah, absolutely.
Doctor Who magazine. Doctor Weekly, as it was at the time, And also Dead London for Big Finish, apparently, which has Roman bits in it.
Which was fairly interesting. So, absolutely. I just think Nardole is the weakest thing, and it's not Matt Lucas's fault. It's just they seem to be misusing or feeling that they don't know how to use him, so they'll just use him as a comic relief. And I don't think that he needs that.
Misusing.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of which, we obviously saw a nice trailer last night, but I just that moment at the end where she's been in the TARDIS the entire time.
Yeah.
I kind of saw that coming, but there's that moment between her and the Doctor where... I mean, are they really selling us a reformed Missy?
I don't think so. Well, if they are, it'll be on the basis, possibly, that she knows from her time as John Sim what's going to happen. So it could be that sort of timey-wimey thing if he appears and she's been feeding off knowing what happened in the past in her future, if you see what I mean.
Hmm. I suppose there is that, yeah.
I hope not.
That has to be an element of it, though, doesn't it? If she is who she claims to be, then she has to know what's coming up.
Maybe. I mean, there is a whole point as they make the big thing of in Day of the Doctor that your memory gets fuzzy as soon as you meet yourselves. So it could be that she won't remember. But I think it's a shame because I think, funnily enough, and we can go back to the scream of Chakra for this, Shalka, whatever it was called, you know, where they had the wonderful thing of Derek Jacobi in the TARDIS as the master, as the robot. And you think, this almost feels like you could have done this. As if you really wanted Missy in this, you could have done that.
You
could have done what you're doing now. In fact, although you might have just got rid of Nardole. But she could have been, or you could have kept her. I mean, again, you're trying to sort of play the series up. Keep her in the TARDIS. She can have cameo scenes throughout. She comes in and films the TARDIS blocks. The blocks where the TARDIS is out, and she comes in and does those in one go. Or, you know, do you know what I mean? You could work your way around it. She could just guest star. She's not there. She's wandering around the TARDIS somewhere. Totally unable to do anything, you know, anything effectual. And that could have been quite interesting. I mean, do you need that? I mean, it's the whole Buffy thing. You know, do you need to bring the Spike into the team for a bit just to give a fresh dynamic? And I think the problem is here is you're getting this set up to her being reformed, which you know is not going to exist because you know, because the PR has pushed for it, that John Sim, her early incarnation, is going to be in there. And you know that's bound to unravel everything somewhere or another. So it kind of takes away the hope. And I think, again, it takes away the power from the Doctor, who at the moment just seems, again, a bit like sidelined to what the audience thinks going to happen, as well as what the Missy's probably going to do, that he's having to play the hope card, as if he's constantly never on the game with her. Not on the game, that's a bad term. He's never on the ball with her.
Oh, dear. What a wonderful...
I know, absolutely. Nice. Switch, but yeah, I quite like the Missy scenes at the moment because she plays, Gomez does a really good job of them. I mean, I do think, and especially this season where if she is playing a game, then it becomes annoying. If this is actually meant to be her genuinely for 50 years feeling some form of remorse, which I think is entirely possible for the Master, possible. I mean, I know he's meant to be insane, but there is a certain amount of civility to him, certainly in some of his incarnations, which would make you think that the possibility of him going further along those lines is feasible. And that makes it more interesting. If she's just there playing the same thing over again, I don't know. She's still too much of a caricature, but she does bring life to it. And funnily enough, her lines are funny. Her role in the TARDIS at the end is funny. Nardole isn't, and he's played by a comedy actor. And again, I don't think it's Matt Lucas's fault. I think it's the lines. They just find Missy, I imagine Missy just writes themselves and Gomez just takes it that one step further. Well, I think Matt Lucas just ends up not really having anything to do but just, because Matt Lucas's comments tend to be comments, sorry, Nardole's comments tend to be ones which no one ever really responds to. They're really to the audience, sort of like anecdotes or comments on the situation or scene enders where he'll say something silly and then the scene will move on. So he's not really actually engaging with anyone in a lot of his comedy. It's just him. While Gomez is there to interact, she is there to... There's that lovely bit where she makes a face at Bill, at Pearl Mackie, as she walks past her. And it's just a great little expression. It's a little interaction which Nardole can't have because he's directed at the audience. So Nardole doesn't work, but Gomez is a really good bit of comic relief. Which, again, is the shame because they tied her to the Master... It means that she's ultimately going to always be the sort of adversary where if they hadn't tied her to the Master, if people really liked her, they could have brought her on as a angel Spike, you know, a Spike character, an anti-hero. She could have been there as the, you know, the uncertain anti-hero, the Will Scarlet or the Lancelot, you know, the dangerous but maybe slightly reformed. But because it's the Master, they can't do that. And again, that's the issue when you tie things so much to continuity. I think that's the real shame with Gomez. And I think this was an opportunity where they could have split from that. Gomez could have perhaps even come back or could have even joined the crew if they'd wanted to. But because they keep her tied to the Master because they love that continuity, it inhibits her being able to do anything else and what she's doing. And I think that's a real shame. And I'm still talking too much.
No, well, no, that's fine. Because the listener really wants to hear what we have to think. So, I've... We had this earlier in the season with this kind of rumor led, perhaps, or maybe gut feeling expectation that something else is going to happen, and then something else doesn't happen. You know, with the monks not being Cybermen, even though they, all of their technology looks like Cybermen, and there's other stuff going on that would ease, you know, could have put pointed in that direction. And this thing with Missy being the master or not being the master is kind of hovering around us now, with this whole idea of retribution and then meeting another master.
Yeah.
I guess we're going to have to wait until next week. What did you think of the trailer, though?
I still think the Mondasian Cybermen look pretty terrible.
Do you?
Yeah. They just don't look right to me. I don't know why. It could be me. It could be that I'm so used to black and white images. But, I mean, I've had someone sort of say there's elements of the face they've either excluded or changed, which aren't quite right. They don't work. So they might work when I see them in the episode, but at the moment, they're not quite working. But at the same time, I applaud them almost for doing something different. Certainly different to what the Cybermen have been in this series. And the new designs haven't been particularly mind-blowing, so maybe trying an old design is a bit of fun. But I quite like the idea of the next episode. I know people have been going, oh my God, it looks terrible, even people I normally agree with. But I don't know. I'm kind of, because Gomez has been a bit of fun this series, I think, to some degree, I'm quite happy with this idea of seeing where it rolls. And of course, John Sim as well, even if he's in it for the last 5 minutes, is going to be, for me, I'm really looking forward to seeing him playing in the show again. So definitely, again, yeah. It will depend, I think, a lot of it, again, as it often does, it comes down to how well they play the Doctor into it. Because I think this show, this episode, while I think there's a lot of things which are a bit ineffectual in it, and are perhaps a little low-key or a little confusing or not perhaps played out perfectly, it's got a nice feel to it. It's got a slow pace. It's got some nice moments. But it's primarily, it's a Capaldi episode. I mean, people have said, you know, Radio Time's pushing it. You know, it's the Scottish episode for Capaldi. You could say it's a Scottish episode for Moffat. Who knows? But
Or for
Michelle Gomez. But it's just, it really gives him a bit of time to play some bits of him which he hasn't been able to play for a while. And that, I think, is what people remember from it. So there's people from the side got inversion and that. I don't think people will ever really remember the story or the politics that sort of infuse it. They'll remember the big Capaldi speech.
Yeah.
You know, Ark in Space, people remember, you know, the Indomitable Humans speech.
And the bubble wrap.
You know, most of the most famous stories come down to Doctor moments. Genesis of the Daleks. Do I have the right? Remembrance of the Daleks, rice pudding. You know, there's these moments which sort of catalyze. Resurrection of the Daleks, I can't stand the confusion growing in my mind. You know, all these great lines that just sort of embolize around and then create our memories of these wonderful episodes. So I think, yeah, I'm hoping this story will be remembered for the Capaldi bits.
I quite like the way everyone kind of stopped the Doctor doing what he wanted to do at the end.
Yes, that was kind of interesting. I'd like to have seen more of, again, Nadal like that is interesting. And again, Nadal at the end when he's back in the TARDIS and he's back to being the sort of Alfred Nadal to some degree, still a bit comical. I just don't understand why they have so much problems with him. Why? It just gets me. And Bill, there were some things with the Bill, and I'm always very pro, because Davis did it, and I like Davis doing it, sort of pushing in a little bit of gender politics into his stories. And I think that can be quite a good, because as everyone knows, you know, gender is a big issue for societies. There's a lot of people who feel subjugated or are underrepresented, and to be represented in mainstream television can sometimes give people a certain amount of identity. I've certainly been a long-time believer that the Doctor himself, you know, for people who are have a sort of homosexual sexual orientation, was a symbol for them, because it was someone being who they wanted to be in a world where they perhaps didn't feel they could be. So I think it's important to have certain representations, but I kind of felt very shoehorned into this episode with the guy half coming on to her. And she's stuck there in a high tense situation with people she doesn't know, and she needs their help to stay alive. And she decides this is the time where she's going to have to lay the line out that actually, you know, she's gay. And then for them to go, ah, well, we don't mind about that. And I mean, I thought the actual idea was kind of fun. And I thought it was kind of interesting the way it threw it on the other foot. And so it's saying, oh, well, you know, can't all be as enlightened as me as a bisexual. And that's an interesting thing. But it just still felt a bit, I think sometimes with Bill, I think it's interesting with character writing. Sometimes you can fall too easily onto the traits on your character sheet.
Hmm. So it's poorly delivered, really, in short, isn't it?
She's a chef. He's a engineer. He's gay. You know, she represents minorities. You know, these don't have to sort of. I think you've got to be careful. They don't feel like they're just implanted. That these are just.
Yeah.
Because I just don't feel that she'd have said that at that time. Even though, because she said it, you had this quite interesting topic for the audience. But it just didn't feel. It felt almost patronising the way she said. She's like, oh, you know. Suppose I better explain this to you. It's like, do you have to, can't you just be nice? Does that sort of suggest that if you weren't gay, that you'd have been automatic expectation from him that you'd have been attracted to him? Not necessarily. I don't know. It just felt a bit awkward.
Mm-hmm.
It was good, but awkward. And yeah. And the beginning bit with Bill again and her sort of arguing with the doctor, it's a bit of fun, but yeah, no, that was all right. That was all right.
Okay.
Yeah. At the time I was thinking, I think I was still feeling a bit of a leftover from last week, so I was still feeling a bit antagonistic. So I kind of felt she was becoming a bit too much like Amy or Clara. Sort of unbelievable, unrealistic, rather than this very realistic character that we'd be given at the beginning. So I think I was a little on edge with her.
Right.
When she came out quite sort of, again, quite bolshy and sort of, you know, this is what I as a student know more than you as a time traveler. You're thinking, oh, for God's sake, don't be an idiot. But you can sort of take the humor in the moment, and she is meant to be learning from him, and she's obviously got a relationship with him which she probably feels can be a little more fun. And I could imagine her probably saying that. I don't know.
Okay. No, that's fine. Face spotters out there might have noticed Carr was played by Rebecca Benson, who's a Game of Thrones person. I think she's only been in two episodes, maybe one, in last year's series, maybe this year's as well, I don't know. But most of the cast were mostly more or less new to me, I think. Overall a good episode, possibly not the most memorable, but certainly some interesting ideas in there and good production. It seems to be Master Week, though, doesn't it? We've had the news from Big Finish that Sir Derek Jacobi is to reprise, or has reprised, in terms of having things recorded and ready to release, his role as the Master in a new set of audio Doctor Who adventures from Big Finish. Where he's essentially the War Master, Doctor Who, the War Master, Volume 1.
Yeah. Yes, that's interesting, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
People saying, oh, if only John Hurt was still around to play off, but that wouldn't work really either, would it?
Yeah, but I think it might be interesting, but.
I mean,
you'd only be able to do one episode.
Continuity.
Oh, of continuity, yeah. You're right, yes.
Yeah, so no, I think it's a great thing. I mean, I don't know. I'm one of those people who wasn't that amazed with Derek Jacobi's performance. I thought it was fine. I thought he did a great job, but it just felt the sort of thing I would imagine as someone saying, you are the master, you are an evil person, might do. It didn't really feel like it had the nuances of what I like in the Master. Not that Anthony Ainley can sort of be suggested
well,
to be entirely nuanced.
I think there's
nuanced,
a bit of a limit in time for delivering the urbane aspects of the
Master. Absolutely. But my point
there?
Was is that people would, you know, do polls of who do you like the best as the Master, and it'd be sort of like, you know, John Sim, Derek Jacobi, and, maybe Anthony Ainley or whatever. And you'd see large people go, oh, Derek Jacobi, he was amazing. He was like, but he had 5 minutes, and that 5 minutes was a fairly characterised, as you say, because it was 5 minutes. So in a sense, I think it's great, because you actually get to see what he could do with it. Because when I watched him, I just thought, as you say, it was 5 minutes. It seemed a bit caricatured. At the time, I didn't like John Sim either. When John Sim appeared, I thought he was too much doing a sort of silly, you know, crazy doctor-like version. But then I understood what he was doing, and I grew to really like that. And I realised I was wrong. It was a good call. But, yeah, I wasn't over-impressed with him at the time. So to actually have him have a time now where he can actually show what he'd have done, And so people can actually say, I think he's the best master. And they'll have a good, credible reason for saying that, because I'm sure he'll be really good.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And so, I'm glad that he's picked up the role and doing it again. I think that's great as well.
Yeah. He's done four. There's Beneath the Viscoid by Nick Briggs, The Good Master by Janine H. Jones, The Sky Man by James Goff, and The Heavenly Paradigm by Guy Adams. Guy Adams has amusingly said something. Where's it gone? I really like this. Oh, yes. Once I got over the idea that giving my words to Sir Derek was rather like filling the Holy Grail with special brew, I allowed myself a brief cry of joy, which I liked. Derek Jacobi's done a bit of Big Finish in the past. He did Doctor Unbound, which is called Deadline.
Right.
Which you may recall.
I don't, actually.
Okay, it's set in a universe where there's no Doctor Who, and he's like a commissioning editor who turned it down or something like that, and he's having nightmares about it, or he's having a breakdown and living scenes of Doctor Who, where he's the first Doctor, and he climbs into his wardrobe to travel through time and space and stuff. It's very well produced. And there's The Scream of the Shalker as well, in which he plays the Master, trapped in the TARDIS, as we've already alluded to. Only he's a robot master, isn't he? He's an android. He's had his consciousness supplanted into a robotic body.
Mm. Yes, and I like that. I thought that was a great... That was a great bit of work. It was a great idea. It was perhaps one of the few things I thought worked in that story. And it's always surprised me that they didn't actually try to make something out of that.
Mm. Well, you know, the whole thing, series. Or... Yeah.
Well, not the whole thing, but just that notion. Because if you've got a character, I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? The problem when you have a good villain, and this is obviously what happened with the Master, as it happens with every villain, is that you sort of have stages of the villain. You have the villain where they first meet and they're dominating because the audience doesn't know their potential, and that makes them a very big threat. Next time they meet, the audience know their potential, but there's still the excitement that they've met before. By the third time, you've got the position where you're now getting to the point where the person's potential has been waned by the fact that he keeps losing, to keep having to come back. So he starts to become a weaker character. Mm-hmm. So by the fourth or fifth time, you start to get to the point, well, how do we change this? And obviously one of the times is you do the team up, where they team up with a load of other people to become domitable again. And then by the fifth time, you do the team up where they team up with the main character to sort of play another side to them. And I was just surprised that they've not really done that so much in the new series. I thought that stage with someone like the Master would be an obvious one to do, and you could do through that sort of approach of having a Master who is bound in the TARDIS, who isn't a threat, but you've got the pleasure of having those lines and that dynamic that the audience enjoy, and have it justified. Which, going back to Buffy with Spike, they had a lot of problems trying to work out how to do that, and they did a chip in his head in the end where he couldn't physically hurt people, and that was a great way of sort of keeping him under control to some degree. And I just suppose I haven't done it with the Master. I'd add an extra dimension to it. And they don't do it. And all those stages, if you actually look through Classic Who, you will see him initially in Terror of the Autons. You'll see him come back a couple of times, and then you'll see him come back with the Daleks, because he's got to be compiled with other people to start, and the Ogrons. And then after that, you eventually get him where he has to team up with the Doctor and Legopolis. And you're seeing these natural ways of trying to keep the feeling of interest and tension between antagonist and protagonist. Oh. And it's like, we don't seem to be meeting. And this, I suppose, is the Legopolis moment, isn't it, the moment we're having? Interestingly enough, at the end of a regeneration again as well. So.
Well, he doesn't regenerate till Christmas, does he?
Oh, no, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
As far as we know, anyway.
Maybe it's a long fall this time.
Maybe it's a very long fall, yes.
From the end of the end episode to the Christmas. The beginning of the Christmas, you just see him hit the ground. And I know. But I'm looking forward to. I'm really looking forward to John Sim coming back. I don't know why. I just really am. I just think it's just something really exciting there. I think maybe because he was so good in End of Time. We've missed him. He was so much fun in that episode. The story was quite messy, and it was only really held together by him, Bernard Cribbins, and obviously Tennant.
Hmm.
And they really pulled what was a quite confused, messy bit of drama.
And also it has one of the most bonkers ever Doctor Who cliffhangers.
Yes, absolutely. Which he pulls off.
Amazingly, yeah.
And then you have the great ending, which I know a lot of people love that moment. interesting enough, I know a lot of new Who fans like that, I think, because that relationship between Tennant and Sim, I think, is somehow a little more personal. You've not seen Doctor Who, or we're not so much part of Doctor Who originally, with the Master as a very clear antagonist for a lot of the time. I mean, obviously with Delgado, there was a little more of a friendship there, but this, you know, was a really, there was a lot more of that sort of friendship issue there with Tennant. So I think that ending where he sort of takes on Rassilon is, for a lot of New Who fans, you know, really quite a powerful moment. It's that moment of redemption, and it's quite thrilling. For old classic fans, it's probably like, well, we've seen him reduced in size and destroyed. We've seen him destroyed in his own Escher creation. We've seen him destroyed here. We've seen him destroyed there. You know, he'll be back. There is no redemption for him because he's a constant thing. But for the newer fans, I think that was, you know, quite a big moment. Mm. So I think it'll be a great thrill for them to see him come back as well and see what happens through that. I just think, yeah.
With his goatee as well.
With his goatee, which, it doesn't surprise me. Moffat does. It always feels, it could not be Moffat, it could be someone else entirely, but it just feels his era does like that sort of little nod to continuity. I know a few people are a bit sort of anti it. They're sort of saying that thing in the trailer where he says, give us a kiss, is obviously probably aimed at Missy. And it's like, you know, really, probably just going to go back to silly banter lines, but, you know, I don't know.
Then again, maybe she's not who she says she is.
Well, I think ultimately, again, one of the reasons we like it is for the same reason that we like McGann appearing for the 50th anniversary, is because it gives a certain amount of fruition and finality to a character's arc.
And because we wanted more from them as well.
Well, we did, but I think it's nice. I think with McGann, it's nice because it gave McGann something his character never had and something which his actor didn't have. Whether the actor thinks of it or not, but certainly didn't. I imagine he probably did to some degree. It gives him the honour of having that torch passing. And I imagine this episode with Sim is probably going to be a torch passing somehow or another. Seems likely. They're not going to have him reappearing and Missy as well. It's going to be one or the other, I'd have thought.
That would suggest there would be two Missies at one point then.
Well, yeah, absolutely. If they do, that's what I think he'll probably do. I think he'll probably do the regeneration into Missy in front of Missy. I think that's sort of where we're heading.
I don't like that.
I reckon that's where it's going to go, whether you like it or not. And I think it's a shame because I'd like to see more of Sim. And I think, it's funny, isn't it, how a show which has grown up in so many ways, where it's not shackled by its high-pressured seriality of its classic era, where there wasn't really much time to really do much wonderful planning. Here you have the opportunity where you could have two Masters running concurrently. You could have John Sim come back. You could have Missy come back. You could have John Sim then come back. You could have Missy come back. You could then have Smith come back. There's no reason to have the linear nature. And yet, well, you have a feeling it will be one or the other from here on.
Well, you know, we are apparently on a spaceship heading towards an event horizon of a black hole. So that could play into it as well, the multi-universal opportunities there. Just one thing to finish on. John Sim is now the longest running master on TV. I'm not going to get into Big Finish.
But that was always funny with Sylvester McCoy, wasn't it? Sylvester McCoy ended up becoming one of the longest running doctors.
Yeah.
Given when, so what was that, sort of 87 to 96 technically.
And then Paul McGann won.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, 96 to 2000.
So he hasn't been on TV for 7 years, the Master, but he nevertheless, from 2007 to 2017, 10-year
But then at the same time, would they not argue it would be 2014, where Missy takes over in theory?
Surely then
you could argue that William Hartnell's Doctor is the longest running Doctor because he's appeared, you know, in episodes, the Three Doctors.
He's in the Day of the Doctor.
Day of the Doctor, absolutely. Yes, so, you know, do you go down that route? I don't know. But, yeah, it's an interesting point that he has a long tenure in a weird way. But, yeah, I know what you mean. In a sense, I don't mind this being a passover in the sense that at least he gets that passover, that he gets that, which very few Masters actually get. In fact,
none. Apart from Jacoby.
Apart from Jacoby, have ever had that passover. So in a sense, that's kind of nice. But at the same time, I just think he has so much potential because he's a good actor. There's a lot you can do, especially now you've removed the drums, in theory. I presume the drums stopped as soon as the Rassilon paradox had been completed. So you could now take him on to a different journey. He's a good actor and one that, you know, you should be trying to pull back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so in a time-honoured Series 10 tradition, we will leave you with a trailer for the next episode of Doctor Who Series 10, which, of course, is World Enough and Time. God knows what that means. We'll find out next week. Until then, it's goodbye from us.
I pick a scenario, we drop her down into it, and we see how she does.
Hello. I am that mysterious adventurer in all of time and space, and these are my disposables.
I promise you won't get me killed. I said this was a bad idea.
A 400-mile ship reversing away from the gravitational pull of a black hole.
So sorry, but you're the reason that they're coming.
What are they?
A Mondasian Cyberman.
Give us a kiss.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.